Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a new history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week I'm very pleased to say we have Eric Lohr, my old friend and colleague, on the show, and we'll be talking about his terrific new book, Russian Citizenship, From Empire to Soviet Union. Eric, thanks so much for being on the show.
Great to be here.
I'm very glad you're here as well. We haven't spoken for a long time, and it just pleases me so much to hear your voice. Why don't you begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself?
I am from the North Woods of Wisconsin, where the winters are long, so long that one is tempted to read Dostoevsky and Tolstoy for many months. And that's what I did at a very young age. It got me hooked in this field of Russian history. And I made my first trip there in 1987 as a guy named Mikhail Gorbachev was coming to power and doing all kinds of exciting things. Never looked back.
All right. And then you went to school, and you went to school again, and then...
Went to school at a place called Harvard, where I met a guy named Marshall Poe and many other interesting people, and ended up writing a book about the First World War. And this is my second book.
Yeah. And don't forget your jump shot.
And I also worked on my jump shots.
That's true. You did. And it was good, I have to say. They used to call you Eric the Red. Do you remember that?
Yes.
Kenny. You remember Kenny?
Yes.
Kenny used to call you Eric the Red. This is a little inside baseball for our listeners probably, but you're going to have to suffer that because this podcast is free. So how did you – why did you – if you were paying for it, you wouldn't have to listen to this. Could you tell us why you wrote Russian Citizenship?
I wrote this book for let me trace the genesis of this book.
Okay.
It goes back to when I first began to study Russia as an undergraduate, I went to Estonia. My first trip to the Soviet Union was to Estonia, and then I took a group of students there in my senior year, and we went to the International Song Festival, which had over a million people present in a country that only has 900,000 Estonians. And then, so I saw the power of nationalism firsthand and was amazed by it. And I arrived at graduate school in 1991, just as the Soviet Union was about to collapse, and listened to the great scholar Adam Ulam mutter under his breath all semester, "We didn't know anything about nationalism. I don't understand this. Why is the Soviet Union collapsing? Where did this nationalism come from?" And then that same year, or that later that year, I went to National Association for the Advancement of Slavic Studies convention, and all of the panels were about popular culture, worker clubs, and what kind of films they watched and which they wrote in their spare time. And I had this surreal feeling that the field was not asking the questions that had contemporary relevance and that were burning questions.
Yeah.
They were inherently historical questions.
Yeah.
So from that point onward, I really focused my intellectual development and my the questions I was asking on this big question of the history of nationality in the in this region. The history of the empire, and my first book dealt with that question during the First World War with a series of problems related to fighting the war as a multi-ethnic empire. My second book comes out of my first book.
Mm-hmm. So in the first book, you talk a lot about population transfer, if I recall correctly. That is sequestration of people, especially Germans, not only Germans, though, during the war as an effort to kind of secure the homeland. Can you talk a little bit about what you found there? Because I, like Adam Ulam, had never heard about any of this.
Okay.
That's, well, it doesn't speak very well of my
right.
Excellent teachers. They were excellent, though, I will say that.
The first book was it's called Nationalizing the Russian Empire, the Campaign Against Enemy Aliens During World War I. And it deals with what happened to the regime as it tried to mobilize to fight World War I. And what it did is basically embrace a virulent form of Russian nationalism that it had held at arm's length for decades, even centuries, prior to 1914. And the argument of the book is that this was extremely disruptive for a multi-ethnic empire. And while writing the book, I looked for, because the question of citizenship was very large in that book, because a lot of the policies the regime embraced were targeted against the citizens of enemy states. So while writing the book, I looked for the standard reference work on the history of Russian citizenship. And guess what?
Right,
there was none.
Right.
So that's why I immediately, as I was writing that first book, said, I know what my next project will be. I have to write this huge, I have to fill this gaping hole in the literature. There needs to be a standard work on Russian citizenship. That was my project.
Well, it's interesting because we in the United States think of citizenship as basically part of our identity. We belong to a political community. That's what makes us citizens, and we have all the rights, privileges, and duties or obligations of citizens. This is something that's we're taught in civics class. I think from the very beginning, I can remember this, Pledge of Allegiance and all of that. And I think it is inherent in any constitutional polity that there will be some very concrete notion of who's in and who's out, although there are boundary cases, obviously, in every state because people travel back and forth across the frontier quite a bit. One of the complications I happen to know in the Russian case is that this notion is not what we would call organic to Russian history. There was another notion that is subjecthood, which was. Can you talk about the difference between citizenship and subjecthood in Russian history?
Sure. I mean, just technically, subjecthood refers to the institutions of belonging to the Tsar. So it's the term that's used to describe that relationship while there was a king. And citizenship is what emerges after the Tsar abdicates in February 1917. And so that's the technical. But there are a couple big issues here in terms of how I defined my project and what citizenship is all about in the Russian Empire. Citizenship, in some sense, is precisely what you pointed to. It's the mix of rights and obligations under the law of each individual member of the state. And that is a huge topic, of course, in every country's history. No country has ever had perfectly equal rights and obligations for all of its citizens. We only passed the Civil Rights Act in, 1964? We had separate laws for our separate peoples, and we still do to this day to a certain degree. Russian Empire was, of course, on the far end of the spectrum in that sense. In fact, the whole empire was principled around the notion that each individual estate group, peasants, nobles, clergy, etc., each individual group had its own individual legal status, its own mix of rights and obligations under the law that was inherently different. And that was the whole principle of the old regime. The notion of citizenship as perfectly equal rights and obligations emerged as a challenge to that old regime, and it was embraced by the liberals and the liberal movement and seen as a concept of criticism of the existing status quo. So it's a very interesting long story about the rights and obligations, the challenge from the liberals to the old regime model, and I touch on that in the book. But what I do in the book is very much make that the as a social scientist would say an independent variable rather than the dependent variable of the analysis. The dependent variable of the analysis is membership in the state. And that is simply the set of rules and practices that define who is a member of the state, how someone becomes a member of the state, how one leaves membership in the state, how the border, the physical border of the country is patrolled, immigration policies, that whole mix of things. And that is something that every country has to deal with. Every country has its mix of policies dealing with those kind of questions. And one of the basic points of the book is that Russia is much more comparable to other countries when you really just focus on that mix of questions rather than the big, huge question of equal rights and obligations under the law. If you narrow your focus, Russia doesn't look so different from other places.
Well, you begin the book in the Muscovite period. I quite like that. And one of the things that you just pointed out about the Muscovites, this is the pre-Petrine period, but we might include the Petrine period, is in fact that this was they didn't think about these things very much except in terms of their desire to attract foreigners. In other words, for Russians on the ground or people in the empire, this was not a complicated thing. They were simply subjects of the Tsar, and they might have had a particular relationship to the Tsar, and that required some things of them and gave them certain rights, but this was more or less done by convention. I don't know any Muscovite law that talks about these things, except concerning foreigners. And by foreigners, I mean, it's interesting in and of itself, because by foreigners, what we really mean here is people from Western Europe, at least in terms of the Muscovites. Can you talk a little bit about what these sort of early Russians wanted to, how this question came up for them?
Sure. You know, and this kind of goes against, I think, the presumption in the few things that have been written about subjected history, that sort of the Muscovite era is this era of xenophobia and isolationism, where basically subjecthood was very restrictive and hard to acquire. And I push against that in my first chapter by arguing that actually there was a very strong, as you just mentioned, a very strong urge of the Tsars to attract and servitors and attract people with skills to Muscovy, and to get them into the Muscovite service, and then to hold them in Muscovite service. So I, from that first chapter, develop a sort of catchphrase called attract and hold. Mm-hmm. And I argue throughout the book that this is a remarkably persistent descriptor of Russian subjecthood and then later citizenship policies. It's something that that really is one of the persistent elements throughout. I guess you've seen a recent iteration of that when Putin attracted Gerard Depardieu to Russia, and I don't know how they're going to try to hold him there.
Right. But I mean, this attract and hold thing, I mean, that's a very mild way of putting it, isn't it? I mean, what they would do is they would promise them service positions and salaries, and then they would get them into Russia. Sometimes they would just send them home. I remember they did this in the first part of the 17th century. They just sent a bunch of them home. But oftentimes they would just imprison them. They would just tell them they couldn't leave.
Oh yeah, well, and the most famous case is Patrick Gordon, who this great military leader who came to Russia and then wanted to go back home, and his family was essentially held hostage, and he was not allowed to go.
That's right.
So that wasn't a singular case. There were other.
No, there were a lot of cases like that. That's right. It sort of changes a little bit with Peter, who's much more enthusiastic about attracting foreigners. I mean, another thing to say about the Muscovite period, and you do point this out in the book, is that the church didn't like these people, and they wanted them to convert. They wouldn't convert, at least they often wouldn't convert, and there were riots against them. I mean, people were very, I mean, the common people, I guess I would say, at least those in Moscow and big cities, were very suspicious of these people.
Right.
Yeah. So in Peter's time, and then, of course, Catherine's time, it changes, because they make a much more thoroughgoing effort to bring Central and Western Europeans to Muscovy as experts. How does, I guess we might call it immigration and naturalization policy. The Muscovites wouldn't have understood that at all. But how does it change in the 18th century?
Well, in the 18th century, there's a notion that the strength of a country is related to the size of its population. Mm-hmm. And that becomes all the more relevant once Russia fights a series of wars with the Ottoman Empire, culminating in 1774. With the acquisition of the vast Black Earth steppe region, which is a tremendous moment in Russian history because it opens up for the first time really productive farmland for settlement. But the problem is there are nomadic groups in that region, and to really secure that region, you need people who are tilling the soil. And so Catherine pursues a policy of sending invitations to various groups throughout Europe to come and settle in this steppe, and gives them all kinds of exemptions from the basic obligations. Talk about the mix of rights and obligations under the law. She essentially gives exemptions from military service, from taxes, gives free land, to gives total religious freedom. Russia, somewhat counterintuitively, becomes a destination for the escape from religious persecution for many groups, mm-hmm. in Mennonites and Protestant sect groups that settle in the southern Ukrainian steppe and in the Volga region. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of the culmination of the attract and hold policy is in the late 18th century. And it becomes a factor that continues in different ways into the 19th century as the focus shifts a little more to industrialization.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and another thing you point out in the book quite correctly is that in the 17th and 18th century, this sort of policy, that is giving people emoluments of various sorts to go to places that you want to settle, is not at all unusual. I mean, I'm thinking of, for example, Cromwell in Ireland. I mean, he basically told the Scots if they went there, he'd give them the whole place. And I'm sure it occurred in a lot of places in Central Europe. That's how all those Germans got there. And the Poles were doing it. You know, these large Jewish populations end up there as well. So it was a known thing that you needed to settle this territory in order to hold it. So many European monarchies had policies like this. I mean, you know, in a way, this is how the New World was settled. You know,
that's over. Right. And I think you know a thing or two about Kansas.
Yeah, right. That's right. Yeah. You know,
at one point, a big part of the population of Kansas was Germans from southern Ukraine, yeah, the same right. people who were attracted to South Ukraine with grants of land were then attracted by steamship companies and railway companies to the American West with the promise of free land.
Right. Yeah. So this was pretty much common coin in terms of economic and political development. What the Russians were trying to do, they faced a certain amount of resistance from the population again in the church, because the church, you know, one of the things I think we have to say, this is sort of the elephant in the corner, is that. For Russians, I think, and I'll ask you to respond to this, the notion of citizenship prior to the 20th century wasn't so important as what we might call ethnic identity. And by this, we mean ethnic religious identity. So you needed to speak Russian, and you needed to be Orthodox. How did Russians react to the coming of all of these Germans and Jews and Poles and all these other folks that were coming in to settle the southern frontier, Ukrainians?
Well, it's a complicated story. And I would say initially that the policy certainly that Catherine pursued was to leave them alone. I mean, the idea was that everyone had to have a religion, but mm-hmm. that if they were, for example, Muslim, then it was expected that they would be under the authority of the Muslim authorities in that region. Mm-hmm. And likewise for the Germans, the Baltic Germans were left pretty much to their own devices, and the Lutheran Church in Estonia ran affairs, and that was just fine for the imperial regime. But things do begin to change in the middle of the 19th century, and they change in somewhat counterintuitive ways. And ironically enough, the very principle of citizenship as equal rights and obligations under the law is one of the reasons why things get tougher for example, the German colonists on the steppe. Because remember, they were attracted by the exemption from military service, first and foremost. And suddenly you have the reformist administration of Tsar Alexander II come in with his henchman, Dmitry Milyutin, who introduces him.
I've never heard Milyutin called a henchman, but go ahead.
We call him a henchman today.
Okay.
This concept of military reform, which is grounded in the principle of universal citizenship, right. that every single person in the realm should, in principle, serve in the military. And this is something that gets these German colonists very upset, and it leads many of them to decide to leave the empire. And it's right around those years when the introduction of this, when the elimination of the exemption originally given to these colonists, that is the year in which mass emigration of these groups begins. Mm-hmm. So it's all kind of interrelated in interesting ways.
How did they let, you know, I've always wondered about this, you know, because I have this sort of I don't know 19th century Russian history very well, but when one of these German colonies said, yes, we'd like to immigrate to Kansas, how did they do it? I mean, did the authorities just say, okay, we'll put you on a boat?
Well, it was a big business, actually. The steamship companies started appearing on the Black Sea really quite early, and they got money from actually the people in charge of settling in the West would actually pay for settlers to settle the land mm-hmm. and for cheap labor. And they would actually pay the steamship companies to go over and do it.
Why did the Russians let them go, though? That's my question.
These German colonists also had money to pay for the trip, and so they could pay for their own tickets. And the steamship business was a big one.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting moment to me, because you do see a mass migration, but it's unusual that the Russians would let them go. I don't know why they did it.
You know, that's an excellent point. And in fact, the Russians did not, the Russian regime was not very keen to see these groups go. And in fact, they put many barriers to the operations of these steamship companies. In fact, it was illegal to try to sell steamship tickets or provide information about free land in Kansas. It was actually illegal to do that. Emigration agents were banned from the Russian Empire, and they were often rounded up and arrested and fined. So the regime, you're right, and the power of this attract and hold policy was really quite remarkable, and it lasted all the way until the end of the regime. Technically, emigration was never really fully legalized. And even in 1910, as hundreds of thousands of people were emigrating from the Russian Empire, even then, I found in the police archives campaigns of policemen around the empire. They're ordered to go out and find emigration agents and denounce them, round them up, give them fines, stop their operations.
Well, I mean, you make a very good general point, and that is if you have a system of particular privileges under subjecthood, if you try to transition to a system of universal rights and obligations, some people are going to benefit. That is the ones at the low rungs. But the ones at the top rungs, that is like these settlers who are given exemptions, are going to suffer.
That's right.
That's a huge problem. I mean, I don't know how you write that. I'm thinking one interesting thing is the and one I know a little bit about, thanks to our friend Witold Radkiewicz, is the Zapadny Kraj. That is this area where there were a lot of Catholic Poles. And they I don't know if you know a lot about this, but the Russians really in the later, mid to late 19th century, scratched their heads about this place. They didn't know what to do because they were Catholics, and that wasn't good. But on the other hand, they were productive members of the empire. That was good. Can you talk about these people? Also, Finns as well. Finns, you know, what do you do with Finns?
Well, you know, the interesting thing that I learned while writing and researching this book is probably not that surprising to scholars who know what they're doing in studying empires. That empires are enormously complicated. And the Russian Empire was a very complicated place legally. And if you just look at the diversity of different regions, how they were acquired by the empire, how they were incorporated into the empire, you come up with all kinds of complexities. And none more so probably than the Polish-Lithuanian area that was annexed in the partitions of Poland at the end of the 18th century. The Jewish Pale of Settlement emerged out of a series of decisions not to legally incorporate the Jewish population of this region into the all-imperial population. Many of the restrictions on residence that emerged through the 19th century were responses to perceived disloyalties of the Polish, not just perceived, I mean proven disloyalties of the Polish elites. There were settlement drives to try to bring ethnic Russian settlers, especially nobles, into the Polish regions to try to subdue and take over this region. There were limitations on immigration from other Polish regions in Austria-Hungary and Germany, and limitations on the ability of these Poles to purchase land if they had foreign citizenship. It was enormously complicated, and one of the great anomalies is Finland. Finland had its own subjecthood, its own citizenship. There was a Finnish citizenship, and it was actually the local Finnish authorities were allowed to ban Russian Imperial Russian settlement in Finland in certain cases. Something I had never expected or known actually until I really got into the details on of the registration of the laws, and also into the details of Russians complaining about this. This was a big issue for Russian nationalists.
I think a good way to explain this to Americans, it just occurred to me, would be to think about the Indian nations in the United States. They are under federal, they are nominally independent in some way. They are under federal authority. Except in certain exemptions, and so state police can't go into reservations. They have all kinds of rights and privileges that ordinary folk in the United States don't have, like the ability to open casinos. They're all over the place. But then, if you want to understand Russia, imagine that times 1,000. And you know, large sections of the country, say California, has privileges and rights, or I don't know, Maine is different legally than Massachusetts. And that's really kind of what you find. It's a sort of a, you know, it's a sort of a hodgepodge of different kind of organically developed regulations and customs and other things. And occasionally you have one of these bureaucratic, one of these initiatives from the top, like let's Russianize the polls, which of course can't ever work. But you know, there's attempt made to do it, and you know, it ends very badly. So
that's true. And I mean, another parallel might be the sort of the French, say Quebec within North America, or New Orleans, where you actually have a long and a deeply developed set of historical traditions going way back, including citizenship traditions, Code Napoleon, and all kinds of legal. Traditions that are living traditions that are real, that they're complicated. How do you incorporate a region like that into a very different type of set of legal traditions and administrative traditions?
That's why I said the easiest thing to do is what they had always been doing. Is they go conquer an area, or people come into the empire and they say, "Well, you're under the Tsar's protection, and you get to maintain your own peculiar rights and privileges." And there, we're done with it. There's no debate about it. But once you try to universalize, which is what they were trying to do after they had kind of nominally become westernized and thought that universal citizenship was the best idea, they basically created a huge problem for themselves, because this is not something that can be homogenized very easily. Any more than, I'm thinking of Kansas and Missouri. I mean, that was a hard thing. That was a hard thing to universalize too in the mid-19th century. Missouri was a slave state and Kansas was not. And when the federal government tried to homogenize, it was a huge problem.
That's right. And so all kinds of challenges. And then when the next big story in the book is when the regime decides to industrialize rapidly.
Yeah.
And when it does, it has to decide, how to do it. And one of the fundamental decisions taken in the time of the Great Reforms was the decision to reform immigration and naturalization laws to favor foreign settlements and investment in Russia. And I was really struck that this was discussed at the highest levels at the very earliest stages of the discussions behind the Great Reforms. Uh-huh. Before the emancipation of the serfs, already in the 1850s, Committee of Ministers was meeting regularly to talk about how are we going to attract foreign capital to industrialize. Of course, coming out of the Crimean War, this was the imperative. The regime needed to modernize and industrialize. That was the driving force, the reason why emancipation of the serfs and all of the great reforms were undertaken. But it was really striking to me how explicitly they talked about strategies to try to attract foreign capital and foreign skilled workers, technicians, investors, the like. I never did write the article, but there's a part of my chapter is called "The Forgotten Great Reform."
Mm-hmm, yeah,
and it really was. It's a great one of the great reforms that I think deserves its place among the list of four or five of the most important of the great reforms. It's the reform of immigration policy, and it really makes it a great deal for a foreigner to come to Russia. Because prior to the 1850s, in part under the really conservative regime of Nicholas I, he was pretty strict about keeping control of foreigners and dangerous foreign ideas coming into Russia. But going back in Russian history deeper than that, there had been a series of limitations on the rights of foreigners in Russia, including a famous double tax that they had to pay.
Mm-hmm.
That was all eliminated in one fell swoop in 1860, and then in 1864 in this great reform, which really made foreigners equal to Russians under civil law, and in basically in commercial courts, they had fully equal status. But there's more than that, because foreigners, of course, don't have to serve in the Russian military.
Mm-hmm.
So when the Great Reform introduces universal military service, foreigners become a really privileged state in Russia. They have all of the benefits of being a foreigner and all the benefits of being a Russian citizen at the same time. So one of the curious things in Russian citizenship history is after this Great Reform is introduced, is indeed many foreigners do come in, get involved in economics and in developing the industrial sector and trade and industry, etc. But they stop naturalizing because there's no incentive to naturalize anymore. It's much better deal to be a foreigner. You're exempt from lots of onerous obligations. Plus, you have diplomatic protection in case something goes wrong. So many of the investors of the 1870s in the second, third, and third generations already in 1910, 1914 still haven't naturalized. That creates an interesting dynamic in Russia because Russian nationalists, Russian industrial groups who have a nationalist tinge to them, they notice this and it becomes a big issue for them. And they become quite strong opponents of this privileged position of foreigners in Russia, and develop some of the more interesting, more programmatic, you might say, more ideologically coherent ideas of Russian nationalism that there are out there to find in the late 19th century. Mm-hmm. So there is a prehistory to the kind of things that happened in World War I. Of opposition to the attract and hold policies of the regime as it develops, and to this open policy of giving privileges basically to foreigners within Russia.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think one of the things you point out in the book too is it worked. A lot of foreigners came, and a huge amount of direct foreign investment occurred, and it spurred Russian economic development. So in that way, the policy was quite successful, at least economically.
Absolutely. It was extremely successful and not all that extraordinary. I mean, one of the things about industrialization history, if you look from country to country, it's really quite remarkable what a huge role foreign investment and the movement of capital and people across borders has played in every major industrialization in France and the United States. I mean, direct investment from Britain was huge in the United mm-hmm. States in the 19th century, mm-hmm. And from other places as well. So it's not really that extraordinary in Russian history, but I think we see it as extraordinary because of what happened in World War I and in the Revolution, mm-hmm. when suddenly you have a massive turn against this foreign role. It starts in 1914, and this is one of the central points in my first book. It starts in 1914 when Russia ends up fighting against Germany, the great economic powerhouse of Europe at the time, and the most prominent foreign investor in Russia. Direct foreign investment mostly came from Germany, and there were lots of German citizens in Russia running multinational corporations or just simply direct investment operations in Russia. And suddenly in 1914, all of these people come under suspicion. The government introduces measures to liquidate their properties and transfer them to Russians or to citizens, you might say more broadly. And it's very disruptive. And it creates a set of precedents, too, for nationalizing properties that I think is somewhat significant in the lead up to what happens in 1917 and 18. And then, of course, everything falls apart in 1917 with the February Revolution, the October Revolution, and the Bolsheviks come to power dedicated to liquidating all property. This is a basic Marxist tenet, but it's also a wartime tenet because that's what the regime has already been engaged in a large scale in relation to foreign firms present on Russian soil. So you have the nationalization order to nationalize all foreign businesses. Now that has a kind of curious little history as well. You would think that nationalization of foreign businesses would be the first thing the Bolsheviks would do. Actually, it wasn't. Nationalization of domestic industry got underway on a kind of spontaneous fashion right from the moment of the seizure of power by the Bolsheviks. But the actual decree to nationalize all business comes in June of 1918, 6 months later. Mm-hmm. It includes the nationalization of all foreign business and the renunciation of all foreign loans. Mm-hmm. This is really the point of no return for the Bolshevik Revolution in some sense, because half of all gross domestic capital formation in the three decades of Russian industrialization prior to 1914 came from abroad. by renouncing all of that and basically cutting off the possibility of a foreign source for Russian industrialization, Russia was basically giving up on the one alternative it had to forced industrialization based on domestic resources. Mm-hmm. So in some sense, Stalin's later decision to launch forced industrialization via collectivization was to some degree prefigured by that fundamental decision of 1918. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing is that all of this, total war in World War I, and then the Civil War with all of its traumas and industrialization and everything, takes a huge couple of steps away from the citizenship policies of the previous 50 years. And you might even argue longer than that, the entire attract and hold policy that had predated even the Great Reforms. Russia really begins to move in a fundamentally different direction, the direction of autarky, of mm-hmm. cutting itself off from the outside world. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people might say, well, you know, the 1920s are an interesting period because...
I was going to say that.
Yeah. So, you know, the workers of the world unite, come to Russia. It's a period of openness to the world, right? Well, when you look at the details, not so much. I found a really great picture that unfortunately we didn't get a good enough dots per inch to put on the front cover, but it's on the back cover. It's a border post in Estonia, and it says "Workers of the World, Welcome" on a big, huge, colorful sort of gate. And in front of it is the most forbidding set of barriers saying, basically.
I'm looking at it right now. It says, don't come in, basically. It says, sir, you're not welcome here.
Exactly. Yeah. And that was, I think, that encapsulates the policies of the 1920s. Where, sure, the Bolsheviks said, workers of the world, come to Russia. But every time a delegation or a group of workers applied to come, the agency in charge of immigration said, wait a minute, we still have unemployment here.
Right.
No, we can't bring these people in. And the NKVD had final say, the OGPU actually had final say over every immigration decision. And they kept saying, well, they might be workers, but we'd have to vet every single one of them, and who knows what their backgrounds are. I think it's safer not to allow them to come. So the long and short of it is, only a tiny percent of those who applied to come to the Soviet Union in the 1920s actually are allowed to come. And those who do come find that conditions are pretty dire, actually. I mean, it's work conditions are tough in the 20s, and they write back home and say, you know, this might be the first workers' paradise on earth, but it's no paradise.
Right.
And so they never really get much immigration in the 1920s. And then in the 1930s, Stalin is desperate for foreign assistance, for skilled foreign workers to come and help out. People like John Scott, the University of Wisconsin grad with an engineering degree who volunteered to come to the Soviet Union. And they bring a fair number of them in. But again, the OGPU is so paranoid about any foreigners in the Soviet Union that they allow only 3% of all applicants to come to the Soviet Union in the 1930s are allowed to come. Mm-hmm. And they play a big role in industrialization, but they cost the regime an enormous amount. I think John Scott's salary was something like 30 times higher than the Russians that he worked with at Magnitogorsk, and that was pretty typical. It was something like that.
Yeah.
That was pretty typical. So it was too expensive for the regime to bring in large numbers of foreigners, and Stalin also didn't, you know, he really suspected foreigners, and he really shut the door. He made it very difficult for these foreigners to naturalize. He made it very difficult for them to come to the country. And my book really concludes with Stalin slamming the door shut and stopping the kind of interaction with the outside world that was so important in citizenship history for decades and decades prior to 1914. He really shuts it down.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, this business about nationalizing all enterprises, including foreign enterprises, was truly catastrophic because there was someplace else for that capital to go. I mean, it wasn't as if people in the era had a lack of investment opportunities. I mean, today it's a little bit different because, you know, in Japan, money costs nothing. You can just go borrow money. I was just reading. The interest rate is zero. You know, then there were lots of investment opportunities. The world economy was growing very quickly, and people just turned their back on Russia. It wasn't hard. And they didn't really feel much about it. It'd be interesting to actually trace where that investment money went. I imagine a lot of it went to the United States, but I don't know. Let's talk a little bit about what happens in 1917, I guess, and the Bolsheviks say, okay, now we have universal citizenship. Everybody is a Soviet citizen. How does that change things?
Well,
they
very much do. And there are a couple of interesting incidents in the evolution of their policy, because in principle, they declare that, you know, on a class basis, that the most important thing now is your class rather than your the country that you belong to. Workers of the world unite. You know, the working class has no fatherland, you know, all these kind of things. So like I already mentioned, there was an open invitation in theory to workers of the world to come to the Soviet Union, but in practice, it proved to be quite difficult. Now, the converse was pursued quite actively by the Soviet regime, and that is the notion that non-working class people are not full citizens of the new state. And in fact, this early Soviet Union develops a category called the lishensi, mm-hmm. That is, those who are deprived of voting rights. And they were entire classes were put into this category of lishensi. So former aristocrats, clergy, industrialists were allowed to stay in the Soviet Union, but they were given this second-tier citizenship status, which deprived them of certain key rights. And voting rights are just kind of a proxy for many other rights that came with it, more important rights really for survival in the 1920s, which included access to ration cards, the ability to get reasonably good jobs, access to educational institutions. A lot of these were sort of derived from your status as having full voting rights. So there's the use of citizenship in this unique way to pursue basically class, to use Terry Martin's terms, you might call it class affirmative and disaffirmative action.
I would just call it class war.
Or class war.
I'm not sorry.
It's another word.
Yeah, I would just call it class war, because they were really trying to put these people down or get them out.
They were. And in fact, they did chase out in a famous incident. The regime rounded up a boatload full of intellectuals and expelled them from the country and removed their citizenship. But for the story of citizenship, even more unprecedented in the history of citizenship globally, was a decree in 22. Can't remember the exact year. Anyway, there was a decree issued to give a deadline for all Russian subjects, former Russian subjects of the Russian Empire, spread throughout the world. Many left during the Civil War, seeking refuge in Europe or in China, outside the borders to just run away from the terrors of the Civil War. The regime issued a deadline for them to come back to the Soviet Union and or to naturalize as Soviet citizens abroad. And if they didn't do it by that deadline, then they were all declared to be removed from Soviet citizenship, to mm-hmm. lose all rights of Soviet citizenship. I'm not aware of another country that had ever done something like this. And what it led to was the denaturalization by decree of well over a million refugees throughout Europe. And it was a big problem for Europe because it meant that a million people now had no citizenship. And the world was not keen to issue citizenship in the interwar years. Mm-hmm. France did not give out French citizenship that easily. Nor did all the other places where Russian refugees ended up. And so a polar explorer named Friedrich Nansen was at the League of Nations and developed a quasi-solution for this problem, which became known as the Nansen Passport. It gave stateless holders of a Nansen Passport basically the right to travel, and most countries recognize the Nansen Passport as a valid travel document for people, form of identification. But they still remained technically stateless, all of these individuals. So this was, again, an aspect of what you might call class war, of removing the citizenship of a whole category of individuals. And, of course, most of these individuals were not working class. Many of them were.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you talk about this stuff, I'm reminded of something that Stephen Kotkin says, and that is the Soviet Union committed suicide by fanaticism. That's not the word he uses. By what is the word he uses? By what is the word he uses? Ideological fidelity. Now, what's the word for that? You know, they were by being ideologues. They stuck to these principles, even though they were constantly harming them. I mean, it would have been much smarter actually to kind of have, you know, peace and reconciliation and, you know, get these valuable people back, you know, and invite foreigners to come help build the revolution and bring them in. But, you know, at every moment they were just more interested in settling scores and, you know, ultimately sort of pushing people away and building whatever the heck they were building. I don't think they knew what they were building, but it's just remarkable how impractical a lot of these measures were, particularly in the late 20s and early 30s.
That's absolutely right, and none more impractical, really, than the decision to launch industrialization cut off completely from the outside world. I mean, the costs of that decision were so enormous throughout the 20th century, and so Russia emerges in the 1930s with probably becoming the model for a hermetically sealed country that is attempting to modernize and industrialize, totally cut off from the rest of the world, and without the kind of massive and intensive cross-border exchange of ideas and goods and services and trade and you know, the economists would like to say the flow of people allows comparative advantage to work its wonders and lift everybody's boats on both sides of the border.
Right. Suicide by idealism. That's what I think he says.
And you know what? In the era prior to 1930, throughout the world, one of the primary functions of citizenship was precisely to allow massive cross-border flows of capital and people, and Gastarbeit or temporary workers. Mm-hmm. All of this without totally losing control over who your citizens are. Mm-hmm. So one of the chapters I deal with the emergence of a modern guest worker system that as something that Germany does to facilitate massive cheap Russian labor flows into Germany, and then Russian administrators say, "Hey, that's a great system," and they take it all the way across the continent and use it to deal with cheap Chinese and Korean labor flowing into the gold mines and railway construction of the Far East. Mm-hmm. So the whole world was kind of learning and developing ways to keep keep control of their citizens and who was citizens, while also modernizing. Mm-hmm. And you know, this isn't a purely benevolent thing. I mean, it also was a means to keep, for example, coolie labor cheap, and you know, by not naturalizing. It wasn't a purely benevolent thing, but it did facilitate huge amounts of cross-border movement. And one of the most striking statistics that I found in my research was on the eve of World War I, there were 10 million recorded border crossings in just 1 year, in 1912. By 1930, the figure had gone down to, I can't remember the exact number, but just a tiny fraction, like 1% of that level or something. Mm-hmm. It's a sort of a stark illustration of the way in which Stalin really cut off a often very productive set of cross-border exchanges that had been characteristic of, you know, Russian the Russian interface with the outside world, you might call it, for really quite a long time. It was not just in the late imperial period. And I think I don't know if you agree with what I wrote about the really early periods of Russian history, but I think it's actually has deep roots, this kind of interaction with the outside world, deeper roots than most people would assume.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't generally like hypotheticals, so they're completely necessary for historical explanation, though. Would you say, this was debated for a long time, would you say that Russia was, given its policy toward attracting foreigners and attracting direct foreign investment in the late 19th and early 20th century, would it have been on a glide path to become something a little bit more, I don't know exactly how to characterize it, Western or prosperous, had the Bolsheviks not taken power? Is that the moment, or is it World War One? Because I guess I get the sense from you that World War One was a little bit of a hitch, and that is to say that the imperial government, they felt a little bit awkward about having all these Germans. They felt a certain amount of public pressure to keep them under control. But had they maintained power past 1917, that maybe they would have returned to these policies. But the Bolsheviks just cut that option off.
Well, I think one way to answer that is to look at what happened in 1991, once the Soviet Union, this experiment in autarky, ended. A big part of 1991 was opening to the outside world and re-engaging with the outside world. And, the debate goes on as to, Putin has gone back on some contracts with foreign investors and the like. But, really that debate is over. I mean, it's Russia's engaged with the outside world now.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way that looks a lot more like the engagement of the late imperial period, where there were opponents. The Tsar's regime was not, 100%. They took measures against foreign companies too, and they restricted their activities to a certain degree.
Mm-hmm.
All of it is just I think you can draw a much straighter line from 1914 to 1991 than you can from any part of the Soviet Union.
Yeah, I think that's right.
To Putin's era.
Yeah.
So I think that maybe kind of answers your question about alternative paths, because, I argue explicitly in my book that, in citizenship policy anyway, I'm not saying that this is true for everything in Russian history, but in citizenship policy, the Soviet Union, the Soviet era does appear to be a sort of diversion from the long sort of arc of history.
Yeah.
The long bend of Russian citizenship policy has a jagged sort of diversionary sort of diversion from the path in the Soviet era. And it's kind of back on track again.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I would agree with that. And, and then we have this great natural experiment in terms of Stalinism and non-Stalinism on the Korean Peninsula, and
right.
You can just see it very starkly. If you attract foreign investment, you become South Korea. If you don't, you become North Korea. And I think that applies to the Soviet Union as well. Let me ask one last question before we go to our traditional final question. And that's this: so let's say I'm a software engineer. God, I wish I were. And I say, I need to do. I need to go to Simbirsk or someplace, and I want to join a company there, and eventually I want to become a Russian citizen. Can I do that?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, and how does it work now?
Well, it's gotten harder than it was in the 90s. In the 90s, there was an open invitation for people to come to Russia and naturalize. Putin in 2002 changed the law and really made it a lot more difficult to do so. I think as Gerard Depardieu just showed, if someone high up wants you to be a citizen, it can happen really quickly. I think he was given his citizenship with a 2-week waiting period.
Right. Well, you can buy citizenship. You used to be able to. I don't know if you can anymore. You can buy Canadian citizenship for $200,000. I'm sure some Canadian is going to write me and say, that's wrong. That's all wrong. But I know you used to be able to buy Canadian citizenship. Like, he's given a certain amount of money and you're in.
That's right. And, in the imperial period, the only way a foreign Jew could become a citizen was to open a factory and invest X amount of rubles. And
there
were – Money has its ways of resolving.
Sure, I didn't say this was a bad policy. I just said I don't think it's a bad policy.
But it's true. It's true in modern citizenship. Things are very complicated. I think someone looked at all the ways one can become an American citizen and came up with like 1,200 different paths to citizenship.
Right.
So I mean, it's and many of them involve money.
Well, you know, you can serve in the armed forces. I mean, a lot of foreigners serve in our armed forces, and you know, get immediate citizenship upon successful discharge. But it's a pretty good leg up to citizenship.
Yeah,
I mean, I think most Americans don't realize this, that there are thousands of foreigners serving in America's armed forces. So, so that's another way. So, what do you think of the? Is Russia going to remain open like this? I mean, am I, you know, me, the software engineer who wants to work in Western Siberia, will I still be able to go in 5 years? Or,
you know, I think it will. The question is whether you will want to go there,
rather
than to China or to South Korea or to Singapore. I mean, there's a lot of options out there, and you know, Russia is still facing the question as to how, where it's going to be on the continuum as it exists today, which, you know, it's no longer a choice between Stalinism and fascism and failing capitalism. It's a very different set of choices right now.
Yeah.
You know, it's still a dilemma. And one of the big challenges Russia faces going forward is a looming shortage of labor, which is already there. And having a restrictive set of policies on citizenship and immigration only hurts and only exacerbates this problem. If Russia really wants to get a sizable influx of people to work in factories and work in the economy, it will need to liberalize its immigration policies and its probably its access to citizenship as well. But the coalition behind Putin right now includes a group of nationalists who have made immigration one of their signature issues.
Boy, oh boy.
And the negative thing, too, is that some of the major voices in the opposition, people like Alexei Navalny, have made immigration their target as well. So the popular opposition may actually be harder on immigrants than the regime is. So it's not looking good for the future and on citizenship issues and immigration issues.
Yeah. Well, I don't plan to immigrate to Russia. I can tell you that. I've done enough moving in my life. I think I'm done moving. Boy, oh boy. So anyway, thanks so much for talking with us about the book. Let me ask our traditional final question, Eric, and that is, what is your next project? What are you working on now, other than your jump shot?
I am working on my jump shots, trying to emulate the great Marshall Poe.
I have no jump shot anymore, so please don't.
No, I'm working on three projects, all related to World War I. One is a volume of papers as part of a massive project of 12 volumes of papers on World War I. The next is it's a trade book on just simply the history of Russia during the First World War.
Oh.
For Bloomsbury Publishers.
Uh-huh.
And the third project is a book I'm calling Russia's Last Christmas, a portrait of the empire before it fell.
Oh. Well, it doesn't sound like you're going to have a lot of time to work on your jump shot to me. Maybe you can squeeze it in among your many, many other things. So today we've been talking with Eric Lohr about his book, Russian Citizenship, From Empire to Soviet Union. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I hope everybody out there has a great week. Thanks very much for being on the show, Eric.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure.
All right. Bye-bye.